This is Champions of Justice with attorney Thomas Girardi, and today with attorney Amy Fish Solomon. This is the program that takes you behind the scenes with those who make the laws and those who protect your rights through the rule of law. Hello, I'm Dave Dino. Thomas Girardi is a founding partner of the law firm of Girardi & Keese, and they are known for passionate litigation of corporate giants on behalf of aggrieved individuals. Amy Fish Solomon is the president-elect of the Consumer Attorneys Association of Los Angeles and a member of Girardi & Keese, and they are champions of justice for the little guy. Each week we bring you this informative and entertaining hour, bringing clarity to the headline-generating legal challenges of the day. Let me tell you a little bit about our two guests today, and you'll want to keep track of them because one is on the left side of your radio, the other is on the right side of your radio, you might say. They are Cliff Pearson and Bruce Simon. They are partners at Pearson, Simon, Soter, Warshaw, and Penny, LLP. They met in 1996, representing plaintiffs in litigation against Central Sprinkler that sought replacement of allegedly unsafe fire sprinklers. On the heels of that successful merger, the two began joining forces frequently, eventually establishing a permanent union with offices in Los Angeles and in San Francisco. And their firm specializes in antitrust, class actions, complex litigation, employment law, consumer protection, workers' compensation, professional liability, insurance law, and personal injury. Now, let me tell you about each and every one of them. Clifford Pearson is a civil litigator and business lawyer focusing on complex litigation, class actions, business law, employment law, unfair competition law, and consumer protection. He has attained Martindale Hubbell's highest rating for the legal ability and ethical standards, and in 2006, Mr. Pearson was selected as a super lawyer. Bruce L. Simon specializes in complex cases involving antitrust consumer fraud and securities cases, and for the past 23 years, he was named a partner at a nationally recognized firm and served as lead counsel in many business cases with national and global significance. He is a frequent speaker on trial strategies in business cases and has lectured throughout the U.S. and internationally. Mr. Simon is the immediate past chair of the California State Bar Antitrust and Unfair Competition Section. He is also the past chair of the Business Tort Section of the American Trial Lawyers Association. And also, one further note, Mr. Simon is the co-author of the Matthew Bender Practice Guide, California Unfair Competition and Business Torts. And Tom, that is setting the table.
Hi, everybody. It's very nice of you to join us again this Saturday afternoon. Well, Dave Dino, here's what we decided to do. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of times the star of the show would be somebody like Justice Marino of the California Supreme Court, the dean of the University of Southern California Law School or Loyola Law Schools. And indeed, their occupations have been very important to bring to the listeners of Champions of Justice. If you were to list the top three law firms who do business practice, unfair business practice, mm-hmm. and antitrust cases, mm-hmm. There's no question that the Pearson Simon firm would be one of the three. They're known around the country, not just in California. One of these young lawyers is in Los Angeles, the other up in San Francisco. And they have made a remarkable mark in helping people, some people who don't even know they've been harmed by the mm-hmm. conduct of business, not just in doing some negligent act, but of doing intentional acts against them. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, this whole antitrust arena that we're going to talk about today mm-hmm. doesn't concern a whoops, oh my goodness, I didn't mean to. The antitrust is we intentionally set out to harm the people that are going to buy our products. So they have some very interesting cases they're in the middle of. They have some very interesting cases that they've already concluded. And we thought it'd be a wonderful idea to bring Cliff and Bruce here. They're two outstanding lawyers. They're very focused. They do an unbelievable, terrific job. And welcome you guys to our show.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Let's, first of all, as our producers are going over the show, they say antitrust, and they say, oh, this is really going to be great, okay? People are going to be on their edge of their darn seats listening to antitrust. What the heck does that have to do with me?
Well, so, it has a lot to do with you and everybody else who's listening. Basically, competition is the grease that keeps the machine of capitalism going, as many people, including Adam Smith, have said in the past. And if you don't have competition, the price you pay for something is not a competitive price. And for decades, in fact, for hundreds of years in countries other than the United States, people have found a way to monopolize, to use their market power and leverage to gouge the consumer and other businesses and make them pay more than they would if there wasn't competition. So antitrust is very easily described as keeping competition alive, keeping an even playing field for the average person, keeping an even playing field for the average company that doesn't have the mega power and the capacity to drive their prices down the throats of those other people.
But wait a minute. Stop. I'm a company. I'm putting out a product. My product is real good. I know how to advertise. I get some of the best salespeople in the country to go ahead and sell it. The public loves my ad. They love our people that are selling this product. And all of a sudden, I go up and up and up. Now then, what's antitrust about that?
Nothing. That's capitalism. However, if you pick up the phone, as is the case in most of these circumstances, or more so by email or text messaging now, and you talk to your competitor and say, listen, I've got so much market share, and I know you want to stay in business, so I'm going to give you a little market share, but I want to preserve my position, and this is how we're going to price things so that I can keep my position and you get a piece of the market too. That's antitrust. That's a violation. You talking to your competitors to create an artificial market that raises the price. And these are on a wide variety of products that affect us every day. Let me give you one example.
No, come on. Wait a minute. Stop. You know, this is a legit show, okay? So you're telling me that some company out there who's selling whatever they're selling, widgets, they're selling air travel, they're selling something. They then start calling the other guys and saying, listen, here's what we're going to do. We're going to charge $5.85 for this, and you go along with it.
You got it. Now, let me give you an example.
You Tom. Better, man.
You ever watch Meet the Press?
We have people turning the thing off.
You ever watch Meet the Press? Meet the Press. You've watched that before.
Yes.
I know you have a little time on the weekend, right? Sunday mornings, when you're working out, keeping your body nice and firm, you know, you watch Meet the Press?
Answer the question.
We've not had very many guests go after you like this.
One of the sponsors of Meet the Press, the supermarket to the world, is ADM. Archer Daniels Midland, who's a founder, a guy by the name of Andreas, is friends of presidents and such. Well, one of our first cases, which involved a product by the name of citric acid. And citric acid, so you think, oh, what the hell is citric acid? Well, citric acid is in every soda pop can, in every can of tomato soup. Just about everything that you buy that's in a can has citric acid in it. It's made out of corn. It's a corn derivative product. Archer Daniels Midland is the biggest corn producer in the entire world, so they had an interest in selling their corn products. They fixed the price of this citric acid with all the people that made it around the world. Now, how do I know that? And Tom said, you know, people are going to turn off the radio. Here's how we know it, and it's all public record. A fellow by the name of Mark Whitaker was a mole, went to the FBI and said, they are meeting and conspiring to fix the prices of citric acid amongst other products. And I'm in the corn derivative division of Archer Daniels Midland. And they're doing this, and I want to take them down. And the FBI said, fine. You know what we're going to do? We're going to take your briefcase, and we're going to equip it with a videotape camera, and you're going to walk into those meetings, and you're going to videotape those folks setting up this conspiracy, and then we're going to go after them. And sure enough, he did. And sure enough, he caught some of the highest executives in that company, amongst executives of other companies, conspiring to set the price by doing the very thing you're talking about. He's written a book about it. There's been a movie made about it. This guy actually caught him on videotape, and it resulted in one of the biggest international price-fixing conspiracy cartel investigations and ultimately settlements that has ever happened.
So what you're saying is that they conspired to keep prices artificially high, and that was passed on to the consumer to keep the price of the product high. In other words, the consumer, me, I had to pay more money.
Absolutely right. And that little component part of the citric acid that's in your soda pop can got passed on to you as the consumer. You paid more for it, and that was an illegal price because it was a product of a conspiracy.
But maybe it was only a penny a can.
Well, you know how many cans of soda pop are sold around the world every day? I mean, that's the whole intent. Let's fix the price on something that's so nominal to the average consumer, nobody wants to do anything about it. But it creates billions of dollars of revenue for these big companies. Same thing with the phone companies. Same thing with the airlines and the railroads. They're passing on fuel surcharges to people. Well, it doesn't amount to a lot to the person. He says, I'm not going to not buy my ticket because of this, but it creates millions of dollars of revenue.
Okay, but it seems to me, and I've often heard, that intense competition does the same thing with respect to prices as price fixing. For example, we just talked now about this guy in the syrup, and they were doing the wrong thing. They went to everybody and said, okay, everybody, it's going to be 5 cents. And that's wrong. On the other hand, let's suppose there are a bunch of manufacturers of a product, and Dave Dino is selling the product for 5 cents. You want to sell your product too. You've never talked to Dave Dino. You don't even like Dave Dino. You're not going to price this product because of Dave Dino. You're going to price this product so you can sell the darn thing. So all of a sudden, you know you have to sell it at 5 cents too. The result, it seems to me, between intense competition and something illegal comes out to be exactly the same thing. You're now selling the product exactly the same price as Dave Dino is selling his product. You guys didn't communicate. Matter of fact, you hate each other. Okay, so answer that one.
Well, the answer is very simple, because under the antitrust law, there's something called conscious parallelism, where companies, as you describe it, actually do follow each other's prices, but are not conspiring to set the prices. That, per se, is not illegal. What is, per se, illegal is the fact that you take the next step and you communicate with your competitor, you share proprietary and confidential information, and you manipulate the entire market. And that's what puts you over the line.
Is there unspoken collaboration?
Yes. And the way it is done, especially in this modern age, is by using technology. Believe it or not, in a case that we had, the members of this various companies who were conspiring, they, in fact, set up a separate website and talked to each other on that website with their own personal email addresses so it wouldn't be in the company records. They text each other. More importantly, they share their information through databases and other third parties who they give the information to, so theoretically the industry can report on itself as to how it's doing. But in fact, they're all watching and signaling each other with their prices and their capacities and their utilization and their factory output through these third parties. This happened, for example, in the Enron situation. Enron had a place called Enron Online, and that's where everybody was watching as to what they should do with their prices. It caused them not to have to talk to each other, but it's just as bad as talking to each other when you are using the same information to control prices.
You are listening to Champions of Justice. Your hosts today, Tom Girardi and Amy Fish Solomon, and our guests are Cliff Pearson and Bruce Simon. Tom?
You know what? In the little example I gave where you were in competition with Dave Dino, and the result of that competition probably would force the price lower because Dave Dino wants to sell his stuff. You now realize if you price the product higher, you're not going to sell any of yours. So the intense competition forces the product to go out at 5 cents. On the other hand, if you and Dave Dino entered into a conspiratorial action, an antitrust action, you wouldn't talk to him about 5 cents. You'd be talking to him about 10 cents or 8 cents or something like that. And that's where the consumer gets hit.
That's right. And not only price, Tom, but also what they call capacity. In other words, if I can produce 1,000 widgets a day at 100% of my factory's capacity and that creates a supply and demand situation where there's more supply than there is demand, the price comes down. However, if I agree with you, hey, I'm only going to run my factory 2 days a week and put 50% of my capacity out, that way the supply dries up and the price goes up, that's another way of fixing the price. So you can fix the actual price, you can do it through capacity, you can do it through innovation. Hey, I'm not going to put this on the market, this brand new product, which is better than your last product, until we sell out the one that we've sold out at the highest price. Then we'll put it on the market and we'll fix that one too. There are multiple ways to do it. It's a wonderful world. It keeps economists very rich in this litigation.
You know what, though? I don't see the bad problem there. Let's suppose I have a bunch of things I've made and now I have a better one and I want to sell those. What's to prevent me legally from holding off bringing off my new gadget until I sell the old ones? What would be illegal about that?
Nothing's wrong if you make that decision yourself. However, if you go to your competitor and you share the information about when your new technology is coming out, that is per se illegal. That word per se, which is a fancy word, just simply means...
It's two words, actually.
Yes, that's right.
It's a fancy two words.
I went to a public school, so I, you know.
LA.
But the bottom line is that something that's a per se violation is deemed by the government, deemed by the Department of Justice and the people who made these antitrust laws to be so pernicious, so bad, that it's going to be a violation irrespective of how you rationalize it as a business decision. There are also cases that fall into this area called the rule of reason, which is more what you're talking about, which you can put up a business justification for doing certain things. And in certain instances, you actually can have non-competitive arrangements so long as they don't hurt competition. The antitrust laws are designed to enhance competition, to not have anything that harms competition. They are not set up to specifically protect particular competitors. So it's competition that's the issue, not the companies that are involved.
And over here on the right side of your radio, as I said, you have Bruce Simon. That's Bruce Simon. And he and Tom are going at it. Over here on the left side of the radio, I've got Amy Solomon and Cliff Pearson. And you two have been able to sort of be in the bleachers up to this point. Amy, I want you to be able to jump in here and maybe see if you can put Cliff on the hot seat for a second.
Well, Cliff, I think... you sort of have a flip side or an adjacent side to these issues in terms of consumer protections, and you are doing a lot of class action work, correct?
We are.
And tell us about how class actions sort of fit hand in hand with the notion of antitrust actions.
Well, I think the best way to do that is to give you the example of another case that we have that's also an antitrust case, but is not necessarily a price-fixing case. And that is a case we have against a well-known watch manufacturer. And what this watch manufacturer was doing was restricting the ability of the consumer to get parts on the repair of the watch, and also watchmakers to get those parts to repair the watches. So the consumer at the end of the day was spending a lot more money. Instead of paying, let's say, $100 or $150 to get a watch repaired, they would spend $300 or $400. And they would have to go to an exclusive watch repair person that was delegated or designated by the watch manufacturer. So that's more of a consumer type of antitrust case compared to the price fixing case that Bruce was giving you the example of.
You know, Dave Dino, this stuff is kind of interesting because the guy who's getting his watch fixed, he has no clue he's getting screwed over. You know what I mean? He just goes, okay, well, it's $300. I guess, you know, shrug my shoulders. That's the way it is. In the antitrust situation, it's very well hidden, and in most class actions, it's very well hidden that you, the consumer, are really taking a beating here because of illegal conduct. You know, you mentioned, Bruce, a second ago, air travel and that there are some shenanigans being played there. What is the focus of that?
The focus is that using September 11th as an excuse, the airlines who are in terrible straits and desperate to create revenues started creating fuel surcharges, anti-terrorism surcharges, and other things which sounded perfectly legitimate in the aftermath of 9/11, but in fact were nothing more than a way for them to pad their revenues. Take the fuel surcharge, for example. This happens in the air cargo setting. those people who ship on airliners, their cargo around the world, as well in the passenger setting. You're charged a set amount for a fuel surcharge. That's the same across the airlines. Now, anybody would think to themselves, wait a minute, if I'm flying from San Francisco to New York, the fuel that is used is different than if I fly from San Francisco to Los Angeles. And maybe you get your fuel from a different source. And there's hedging of fuels, so maybe pay less of a price than the other guy. And yet the price was exactly the same. And it turns out the price was exactly the same because they were talking to each other about what that price should be. And one guy didn't want to get ahead of the other guy and get a competitive advantage, so they said, we're going to set this fuel surcharge. We're going to set it at this amount. We're going to stay on that price for this long a period of time. And when we change it, we'll tell you so you don't get screwed. And that's what happened.
Now, so the guy who is going a short distance, who uses a small amount of fuel, pays the same exact dollar as the guy who's going to China.
You got it. And it's not insubstantial. We just had some relatives come over from England, and since we were involved in this case, I asked them, show me your tickets. And they did. And the surcharges on those tickets in American dollars were like $175, $200 of the ticket price. Now, so we're not talking about, you know, that little bit of citric acid in your soda pop can. We're talking about a major material amount of your ticket price related to these surcharges. And the airlines were basically using it to subsidize themselves on the backs of consumers.
Now, you say that they agreed together to set this price. They must know that that's illegal.
They do. And, that's part of the issue here. And that's part of what they come in and say is that they got legal advice. Some very big firms have told them that they can go this far and not cross the line. And they go that far, and then they get greedy, and they go a little bit further. Mm. It's pretty black and white that if you talk to a competitor about your price, about what you're going to set your price at, about what you're manufacturing and how you're doing it and how much you're manufacturing, it's clear that that's an antitrust violation. And no law firm in the country could advise that particular client that what they're doing is correct. There are some exceptions. Everybody remembers Major League Baseball for years and years and years had an antitrust immunity. The shipping industry, ocean shipping, because of maritime laws, going back to the Jones Act, going back to the 1800s, has some immunities. Everybody knows that the phone companies used to be monopolies. They had an immunity from antitrust law. Then they got deregulated and they all went apart in a million pieces, all the baby bells. Now they're all back together again.
They are, okay.
And anybody who has a cell phone, which everybody here does, or a BlackBerry, knows how much we're getting charged now, more than we did when they were deregulated.
The phone companies always remind me of that character in the Terminator movie that was made out of liquid metal. And no matter what you did to it, you blew it apart. And eventually it all congealed back together and reformed itself in the same
form. That is exactly right. This all goes in phases. And another thing to consider, and Cliff knows a little bit about this and he probably can chime in, is there's an international aspect to this. And lest anybody think that we're not a global economy, before I came on the show, I went and looked a little bit about what other countries are doing in terms of antitrust. And countries like Korea, Japan, China, England, the EU are now setting up antitrust laws because they want to make sure that their economies are operating on a fair basis with the economies around the world. Interestingly enough, I was reading an article whereas Microsoft, which was a huge antitrust case here in the United States, that the Justice Department pursued and collected hundreds of millions of dollars in fines and penalties against Microsoft, when the European community went after Microsoft just recently and came out with a ruling against them, the Justice Department was actually quoted as saying, and that's not good for the economy in the United States. So now we have this kind of ironic situation where, we can enforce our antitrust laws here to keep everything on an even field. But if people start enforcing against American companies, we're a little concerned about it.
That is Bruce Simon, and he is one of our guests today on Champions of Justice. Our other guest is Cliff Pearson. Your hosts are Tom Girardi and Amy Solomon.
You know what? Once again, let's go back to the fuel surcharge. I'm just buying the ticket. When you go buy the ticket, you give them your credit card, they give you the ticket. The average guy says, wait a minute, is this a consumer surcharge here the same thing if I'm going to China, if I'm going to San Francisco and things like that? These are all hidden, from the consumer. We're recently in a case, Dave, I'll tell you about. if you buy a gallon of gasoline at the pump and it's warm outside, it's hotter than 60 degrees, mm-hmm. the gas expands in the tanks mm-hmm. at the gasoline station. So now when you get a gallon, you still get a gallon. But if your car gets 30 miles to the gallon, now this expanded gallon doesn't give you 30 miles to the gallon. Mm-hmm. Now you only have 28 coming out of this gallon of gas. And if it's 90 degrees outside when you buy it, maybe you get 26, although you pay for a gallon of gas. Mm-hmm. Then when you're through paying, as you know, you're paying state tax and you're paying federal tax on a gallon of gas. But the gas isn't going to take you that far anymore. It's very interesting. So now then the company has to turn over tax money to the state of California mm-hmm. and also to the federal government. When they turn the money over, they say, wait a minute, we didn't sell that many real gallons of gas. We only sold, if it's down for 100,000 gallons because of the temperature, we really only sold 90% of that. They then only pay taxes on 90% of it. You, at the pump, have paid taxes on the whole thing.
Yeah.
Total scam. Now then, so a lot of people who buy gas in bulk realize this is a problem. So if I'm going to go to Chevron and I have a whole taxi fleet, I say, listen, I want the bill temperature adjusted, so I'm not going to pay you for a gallon when this stuff is being delivered, you know, much, much less than that. And they'll do that for you because you're buying a lot.
Because you know.
Because you know. However, you, idiot, filling up your car with gas, you have no clue. You're not really getting a gallon's worth of gas and paying taxes on a gallon's worth of gas that the other side's putting some of the tax money in their pocket. Unbelievable stuff they keep coming up with.
And a side note to that case, which I'm very familiar with as well, is in Canada, same issue, and because of the climate up there, they put a little device which cost about a buck on their gas pumps to adjust it so that when you put it into your car. But of course, here in the United States, because we have the Department of Weights and Measures and a lot of regulatory authorities that oversee this, nobody's suggested that could happen here yet. But Tom's absolutely right. People who are listening out there, if they examine what they're paying for, the phone company, milk was another area where there was antitrust collaboration. Most things, beer, we had a beer antitrust case having to do with Anheuser-Busch and their distribution network, trying to squeeze out microbrewers. Most of the things that you touch and use and see in everyday life that you count on and need, somebody probably is touching that as well and touching you in the pocketbook.
Bruce, we are talking in present terms. What about the history of our country? I mean, there's got to be some past to this. Our country was built on capitalism. Our country was built on competition. And there were some tremendous fortunes made back in the 1800s and early 1900s in industry. Were those fortunes made as a result of legitimate competition, or did we see, I mean, I believe this is where all of the antitrust laws came from, was because of what happened. Did we see unfair competition? Did we see price fixing? Did we see monopolizing? Did we see unfair practices used to eliminate competition out of the market?
Well, basically, the Standard Oil Trust, which was broken up by the antitrust mm-hmm. laws, was the reason that those antitrust laws were put into place. The Standard Oil Trust monopolized oil in the United States, and the people were price gouged. The railroads were another example going back into the 1800s. They had a monopoly. I mean, think how many railroads there were. There were two railroads that basically joined the tracks in the middle of the United States. Those railroads held a monopoly for the longest period of time. For a while, during the 1800s and into the early 1900s, economists said that giving people market power created efficiencies, it got us to build our country better, and it was condoned to a certain extent. Then when we started to switch from needing to build to getting people getting fair prices and people using that leverage to hurt other people and other competition, that's when the antitrust laws came into effect.
You know what, though? This is very, very strange. The customer doesn't know any of this is happening. The customer doesn't know that he's not really getting a full gallon of gas. The customer doesn't know he's being charged the same amount for fuel for an hour, 10 hours in the air. The customer doesn't know any of this. How many Whitaker guys are there out there? Didn't you mention that Whitaker was the,
right,
the whistleblower that came forward?
There are some, but most are typically scared to come forward. However, the law has changed recently, and an amnesty program has been put into place by the Department of Justice. Before this program was in place, there was no reward for coming forward and blowing the whistle on somebody. Tom is familiar, Cliff, everybody is familiar with what they call qui tam cases. If you defraud the government out of money and somebody comes forward as the whistleblower, they can get a bounty for having disclosed that. That goes back to the Civil War when people were making guns during the Civil War and they were blowing up in soldiers' faces. Somebody disclosed that they were using cheap parts, and that's where this all goes back to. In the antitrust world, there was nothing like that until recently, and now there is an amnesty program, and the first defendant in an antitrust case into the government to blow the whistle on the rest of their co-conspirators gets leniency. They're not subject to treble damages, only single damages. And there's cooperation involved in that. So now the government has, U.S. government has set up an incentive to have people come in and blow the whistle where they get some actual advantages. And that has increased some of the antitrust enforcement around the United States. Of course, the antitrust enforcement is only as good as the Department of Justice office that's enforcing it. And that varies from district to district.
You know, that's really something, isn't it? You know, in the criminal cases where there are a bunch of defendants in a case, we often see the first guy running in. Last week, on O.J.'s case, some guy is running in saying, listen, it was O.J. that wanted the guns, or I don't know if this is true or not, but at least he wants to be the first guy in there to cut the deal. And we see that in the cases against lawyers down in San Diego. All of a sudden, that case, nobody was talking. And the next thing you know, boom, they wanted to say, wait a minute, I have the goods on these other birds. I want a deal. So a company can get a deal now in antitrust, just like co-conspirators of some crime could get, huh?
That's right. And it has encouraged people to come forward because companies realize they can save millions, if not billions of dollars in potential penalties and fines, as well as exposure to the civil litigants like ourselves. And they are coming forward. And other countries are starting to do this as well. I mean, it's not rocket science. I mean, it sounds like it's a big deal, antitrust and all these magic words that lawyers use, but it really is just cheating people. And it's very simple. And when the government tries to enforce the antitrust laws, they're looking at the same dynamic as in a drug case or a gun case or things that you're mentioning, which is get somebody to roll over. If you get somebody to roll over on the other guys, it makes your case easier.
You're listening to Champions of Justice with your host, Tom Girardi, and Amy Solomon. Our guests today are Cliff Pearson and Bruce Simon. Amy, a question for you, and maybe this is one that it could be aimed at Cliff, and that is, as a consumer, I will get notices in the mail every once in a while that talk about a class action suit toward a specific manufacturer. And it is in such legalese that as a consumer, I have no clue what they're talking about, and therefore I don't respond. I mean, it doesn't affect me in my life is how I feel. They're not asking for money out of my pocket. They're just some class action suit against some guy. What's that all about, and why can't I, as a consumer, have this put in more plain language so I know what's going on and maybe perhaps make an intelligent decision as to whether I want to participate?
You can hear from the conversation today so far the insidious nature of the cheating, as Tom calls this.
Mm-hmm.
It pervades in a class action situation, just like you describe. Those notices are getting more and more user-friendly and consumer-friendly, and I think there's still a long way to go on that, and maybe Cliff wants to speak to that. But what's really important is the response to it, that as we've heard, these may seem like little gnats flying around to us and no big deal, but when you exponentially do the math, it means a significant amount to the corporation that is doing this. And that's what's so important about the class action instrument. And Cliff?
Well, the notice provision is a very important part of the case, whether it be through settlement or through winning an actual motion for class certification. What we're seeing more recently is that there are actually two notices that are prepared, one which we call a short form, which is usually no more than a page. And I think courts are working with plaintiff attorneys to simplify these and take out the legalese and use what we call plain language so that the consumer will be able to understand what's truly going on. And then they're directed at a later point in time to the long form, which is usually a little bit more technical, a little bit more legalese, and has a lot more information about the settlement. Part of the other problem in terms of the notice is, how does the consumer get the notice? Is it through publication where it goes in a newspaper like the LA Times or the Wall Street Journal? Or does it go on a website? Does it go in a trade magazine? Or better yet, can it be mailed to the consumer? As plaintiff attorneys, you know, the best option is generally to have the notice mailed to the consumer. But many times in the cases, we don't have the actual address. And when we don't have the address, or if the defendants are being difficult, which many times they are, then we're forced to go with publication. Mm.
And you know, publication, most of us never see.
Well, we try, and we have companies that assist us in telling us which magazines or which newspapers will get to the largest group of consumers that are affected by the case.
You know what, Cliff? You said we try, meaning the bar that's involved in class action stuff. Quite frankly, I think it's been a total failure. The fact of the matter is, Dave, as you just said, you see some notice. Did you buy a share of Maytag stock between the years 1996 and 2000? You could be entitled to something. First of all, you don't even know if you bought Maytag stock. You don't know those things. And then we get those notices all the time that we're part of a class. Now, here we are lawyers. We do this work. I can't make heads or tails out of it. You know, it's something that goes on for three or four pages. Generally, at the end of the rainbow, it's hard to tell if you're supposed to send something in or not send something in. And Cliff, I think, is much good as the plaintiff lawyers have done in uncovering bad conduct. They haven't done very well in trying to tell the people out there in simple language, this is what they did, this is what you're entitled to, and this is what you're going to get. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, but the problem for us plaintiff attorneys, those people that are fighting for the consumers, is that we're handcuffed. And we have to do battle with big corporate America that have hired the biggest and meanest and, of course, most expensive law firms. And they're going to do everything they can to restrict what we can say in these notices. But at the end of the day, it's the court that ultimately approves what goes in there. And it's a tug of war. So I agree with you. It's not as good as it could be, but it's generally the best that we can do.
This is a pet peeve of mine, Tom, and over the past year or two, I've tried to tell these companies, which are a handful of companies talking about, you know, antitrust, that do these notices, trying to convince them that we're in a new age. I mean, look at the political campaigns right now, blogging, YouTube, going out and getting your message out in non-traditional ways. Unfortunately, the law has evolved in class actions that you put it in a newspaper or you mail it. And then you get these declarations from these experts who say that's the way to get it to people. I am firmly a believer in trying to expand it into a high technology world. Blog it, YouTube it, text message it to people, email it to people, set up websites. I think you get as much coverage there as you do in the average way. And if you send somebody an email and say, listen, you're entitled to $100 because of this case. You don't need to do anything, but you get $100 back automatically. You don't have to do anything. You get an email like that, people are more likely to look at it if it doesn't get caught by their spam filter, which is an issue, than if they're reading USA Today and they see this little ad in USA Today. I think the world needs to change in that regard. I agree with you 100%.
You know, we had a case of a class action case of overcharging people who rented television sets. And generally speaking, if you think back, no matter how poor you were in your college days and law school days and so on, probably you never rented a television set. You know, the people who have to rent television sets are people kind of down on their luck. Mm-hmm. You know, they're doing it for their kids and so forth. They got to have one, but maybe don't have the money to do it. And there are laws that indicate how much you can charge the rental of one of these sets. And we caught this company. They were doing the wrong thing. They were overcharging the very people who who can't afford to be overcharged. The notice that went out was very simple. We got some language in there that said, you've been overcharged on your TV rental. Verify your address, and you'll be entitled to a refund. Well, we got about a 90% return with respect to those folks with that.
That's extraordinary.
That's extraordinary. And one letter we got back, Dave Dino, from a lady, she said, I just got this check for $1,000. The reason that the print on this letter is smeared is because it's my tears that hit the letter when I got the check.
Mm.
So every once in a while in this business, in this law business, you do something that is really good. You help somebody who's been harmed, and it's a wonderful darn feeling about it.
That is Tom Girardi, and this is Champions of Justice. Our co-host today is Amy Solomon, and our guests are Cliff Pearson and Bruce Simon, and our topic, antitrust and class action suits.
Cliff, let's move up a little bit there so that my folks out there can hear you, because we've devoted more of our time to Bruce Simon because he didn't demand as much money to show up, to come onto the show as you did.
And by the way, Tom, I did rent a television in law school.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Maybe Tom can get you a check.
It's very clear then that the two of you did not collaborate on what you were going to charge to be on the program.
What's the future of class actions? Boy, there's a lot. I mean, corporate America does not like this stuff.
It's getting tougher and tougher. With the Republican legislature and our president the last 6 years, they're making it tougher for us to bring the cases. And especially with the appointment of new judges by our president, they're much more conservative and they're restricting our ability to pursue the cases.
Don't you think, though, there are some abuses?
By plaintiff attorneys?
Sure.
There's abuse in every business. There's also abuse by corporate America.
But go back to the story you just told, Tom. Because of a few people that abuse the process, do you want to take away the ability of that woman to get her $1,000 check back and shed tears on the letter? I think the answer to that is clearly no. We are under siege. Cliff is being a little polite, but I'll say it. We're under siege. They're trying to take away the rights of consumers every day. There's something called the Class Action Fairness Act, which was enacted by Congress a couple of years ago, fairness being the biggest misnomer that ever existed. That has had a ripple effect on class actions like you can't believe. Take antitrust, for example. Not to get too technical, but you know, if you direct or you're a direct purchaser, you buy directly from the manufacturer, you have a claim in federal court. If you buy from somebody who sold it to somebody else and then sold it to you, you may have a claim in state court. Those people were able to go out and get their separate remedies. They weren't cumulative. They weren't mushed together, and there were no problems. They went down their separate tracks. Now, under this Class Action Fairness Act, all these cases are mushed together in federal court, where they're subject to a lot more restrictions and a lot more problems. Also, a case just came out called the Twombly case in the antitrust world, which is expanding now into consumer world and everywhere else, which has tried to raise the bar on antitrust cases. And in that particular setting, now, as opposed to just saying there's a reasonable theory for your case, any reasonable theory, and then you get past the pleading stage and go on and take discovery and get those guys who were in the room when they were conspiring, now you got to give something more, and the bar is higher. And the defense bar is trying to take that case and expand it into consumer actions and everywhere else. So we are under siege, and they are trying to take people's rights away, and they're using the abuses as an excuse.
You know, in the drug world, we've been very much involved in a bunch of drugs that are withdrawn from the market because they did a lot of harm. Reslin wiped out people's livers. Vioxx caused heart attack and stroke. The list is endless. And all of these drugs, before they were on the market, were approved by the FDA. You have to have a drug approved by the FDA before you can sell it. The problem is that the FDA has 3,500 people approving drugs and fewer than 100 who look at drugs after they're on the market to see the side effects of those drugs and the problems, the cough syrup to little kids under two and things of that nature. Now then, the U.S. Supreme Court has granted a hearing in three different cases which talk about an issue called federal preemption, which means simply this. If the FDA approves the drug, no matter what it causes, no matter how bad it is, no matter how lousy the approval of the drug was, nobody can sue. Approval, that's it.
Wow.
Same thing with respect to motor vehicles. If, in fact, there's federal approval of a seatbelt design or something like that, even no matter how bad it is, boom, there can be, if, in fact, preemption, federal preemption comes into play. And the fact that this court granted a hearing on three different cases that'll be heard this year, I mean this term, up till next October, sometime between now and next October, has a massive amount of concern among people who represent people who have had heart attacks, have had strokes, have had their liver wiped out, et cetera, by these various drugs.
And the drug manufacturers are known to flaunt the antitrust laws as well. Everybody knows what a generic drug is. Theoretically, the generic drug is going to come out on the market, open up competition, so the name brand drug comes down in price, and the generic is a lower cost substitute.
Okay, just a minute before you go too far. I'm a drug manufacturer. I invent this drug.
Right.
I now have various rights to this drug.
Including exclusivity to sell it under your brand name for a period of time until the generics can come out.
And then, however, I lose the right to have exclusivity after a certain number of years.
Right. And you know what was happening? That brand name drug manufacturer was suing the generic drug manufacturer saying, no, you can't use it. It's our trademark. It's our patent. You're copying us. And they'd hang them up in litigation for another 2 to 3 years and then settle with them to take that off the market.
Well, also, isn't there proof also that quite often the drug companies would then try to collaborate with physicians and get the physicians in their prescription to specify brand name only?
Yes. And there's issues with respect to capitation rates and all sorts of things in the medical profession, which not the doctors themselves, but at least the groups that are putting together all this, along with the drug manufacturers, have major issues, which some of which are being litigated, some of which are not even known. I mean, another area that's ripe that we're looking into and have some cases involving are rebates. Mm. When's the last time you tried to get a rebate on anything? Did you know that in the United States, there's a handful of companies that process all the rebates for the major manufacturers around the United States? I think three or four of them are in Minnesota. One's down in Arizona. And trying to get a rebate when you're promised a phone for free, for example, and you walk in and you buy this phone, you see the phone you've wanted forever, and it's for free, subject to getting your rebate back for $100. Try to get that rebate. It's the most difficult thing in the world.
Next thing you know, you're putting in $500 worth of effort to try and get $150 mm-hmm. bucks back, mm-hmm. you know, is how, you know, the to go back to the drug stuff, you see these prescription drugs that are advertised on television all the time. That's strange, isn't it? Why, if I'm not a doctor, I can't even prescribe a prescription drug. A doctor has to do that. The reason that all these ads take place, be it Vioxx with the ice skater twirling around and so forth, to me, the consumer, that maybe, gee whiz, playing golf, I got a little pain in my right knee. The reason, even though I can't prescribe the drug, I go to the doctor and I say, hey, listen, I want Vioxx or I want Celebrex. I want something like that. And it's so massively effective that by going to the consumer on a prescription drug, that's the reason all those ads take place.
Yeah, those ads are amazing. I mean, you look at the life that's going on in those ads, and you go, I should be on drugs.
Exactly. So here's what you have. Here's what you have. And you, Cliff, and your partner, Bruce Simon, do an awful lot of good. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on out there that the people don't know about it. I know when somebody, some drunk, runs into the back of me, I'm aware that now I've been harmed. And the stuff you guys do, you're helping people that don't even know they've been harmed. And they've been intentionally harmed by the conduct of others. So I really take my hat off to both of you. You're doing a hell of a job.
Thanks
very much, Tom.
That is going to bring us to the end of our time together today. You have been listening to Champions of Justice with your hosts, Tom Girardi and Amy Solomon, our guests today, Cliff Pearson and Bruce Simon, and we've been talking about antitrust and class action suits. I was reading this week about Sparta, ancient Sparta, and a king, an ancient king of Sparta, was quoted to say this. When he was asked about how he wielded power and why he wielded power in such a fair manner, he said, We are given power to do good, not license to do evil. Well, our country gives businesses the right to do business, to participate in the capitalistic system. But they are given the power to do good and not the license to do evil. And our two guests today, they are protectors of that power to do good. And as such, they are champions of justice. Thank you for listening. I'm Dave Dino. Our producer is Jennifer Lenz. Join us again next week. Bye-bye now.